Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we are going to spend the next part of our program, 45 minutes or so, talking about the killings that have taken place in our state prison system, but really kind of delving more deeply into why and if there's any way to stop them. And we have a really interesting guest. We're joined by Harold Bailey, Dominique Stevenson, Waheed Shakur, and Joe Castley in a few minutes. They'll all be here talking about that from very different perspectives and their own perspectives. Both two of our guests have spent a lot of time incarcerated and have that perspective, but from an interesting perspective on that. Joe Castley being a very conservative state's attorney, he'll be joining us as well, and he's been on the show many times over the last 20 years, man I respect. Right now we're about to talk to Mark Vernarelli, who's Director of Public Information for the Maryland Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services. And Mark, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Mark, thank you very much.
So, Mark, in the few minutes we have here with you, let's just talk about what's your department saying? Has been one murder a month for 7 months, if I have that right, correct?
Well, Mark, we have absolutely seen a spike in homicides, 7 in 7 months, but I think the bigger picture here is really important, and that is that since 2007, overall institutional violence is down significantly. Serious inmate assaults are down by almost half, and inmate on staff serious assaults are down 65% since 2007. So while we've seen this recent spike in homicides, we have really done a lot of work, and a lot of people in the correctional system and our partners have worked hard to reduce violence, serious violence overall. And I have to say that we thoroughly review every single homicide. We have a top-notch internal investigative unit, work with the state police. Of course, by law, they investigate. They're the primary investigators in prison homicides. But we review every single homicide to ensure that all our procedures and policies are followed. And so far, with these 7, we have not found any pattern. We have not found anything that warrants procedural change. We have not found any evidence of staff negligence or wrongdoing. And we have not found any common thread in any of these homicides, except that in at least 4 of them, the suspect is the cellmate. And of course, again, Maryland State Police, they are the lead agency, so I don't have the specifics of their investigations, but in at least 4 of the 7, with several of them still under investigation actively, the cellmate is the main suspect. And as you can probably imagine, homicides where the cellmate is involved are usually very spontaneous. They are not premeditated, they're not planned, they're not gang-related, and they're very difficult to prevent. We screen inmates as best we can to ensure that cellmates are compatible, check for known enemies, and things of that nature.
So, 2 very quick questions before you go. One is, some people on one side would argue which we will wrestle with here on the show, will argue that there would be less instances if it weren't so many people incarcerated in the first place, much easier to manage, and also the idea of separating the most violent criminals from others who are serving time.
And I can tell you, Mark, that a lot of people don't realize, in the midst of national statistics that seem to indicate otherwise, that our prison population has actually declined somewhat. It was around 24,000 in 2003. We're now between 22,000 and 23,000. And, of course, we have no say in who gets arrested or how many people.
No, I know you don't, but I'm
just
saying.
It's a lot of people don't realize that the population actually has gone down a little bit. It's not. It has not gone up in the state of Maryland as it has in some places.
No, I understand that. I'm just saying that people can argue that part of the problem is there are just too many people in our prison system, period.
Well, you know, we hear that from a lot of folks. We, again, have no say in who gets arrested.
I know that.
Well, I tell you what we try to do, Mark. We try to do as much as we can for the folks incarcerated to keep them not only from being killed, but to keep them healthier and to keep them in programs, restorative justice programs that will get them actively involved, employment readiness programs. We're doing the very best that we can to try to actively engage inmates. And I have to also say that overall inmate deaths from all causes, suicide, homicide, natural causes, are also down significantly by almost a third since 2006.
Right.
So we are trying the best we can. Homicide is not something we can always prevent very easily.
And finally, other people are from the other side that if we had the death penalty, then it wouldn't be these murders in prisons.
Well, and you know, that's something that's been a lot of debate about, particularly with this legislative session. And again, we can only do what the law requires and allows. And our goal is to keep inmates alive, keep them healthy. We've made tremendous strides in health care. Our HIV deaths are down. Our HIV testing is way, way up. We're utilizing far better medical care, far fewer emergency room trips, far fewer trauma trips to the hospital. We're doing everything we can to keep inmates alive and keep them well. And Can we prevent every homicide? Of course not, but we're certainly working with our correctional staff and our partners on the outside to actively engage inmates in as many programs as we can and to try to do as much violence reduction, contraband interdiction, intelligence sharing, gang intelligence as we can. And since 2007 in this administration, I think it's really made a big difference.
Mark Venarelli is Director of Public Information for the Maryland Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Mark, very much.
Take care, Mark. We are now joined here in studio. Harold Bailey is with us. He's partnering with the Turk House Recovering Centers to provide peer-to-peer counseling, social counseling workshops, and employment preparation services for formerly incarcerated men, and did time in our state prison system himself. Harold, welcome back to the program, an OSI fellow as well.
Thank you, Mark.
Good to have you here. Dominique Stevenson is back in the studio. She's Program Director of the American Friends Service Committee, the organization that operates Friend of a Friend in our prison system. Good to have you back, Dominique.
Yes, thank you.
Waheed Shakur is back with us, incarcerated at the age 15, released at 20, and also works for American Friends Service Committee. Good to have you with us.
Waheed. Thank you.
Good to see you again.
You too.
And Joe Cassidy joins us by phone. He's Harford County State's Attorney and has been coming on the show to debate and discuss things for many, many years. And Joe, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be with you, Mark.
So, the murders were one thing we were going to talk about. I think we can start there. I think that 1 a month for 7 months is something to take notice of. It's not a small issue, whether overall rates of violence are down or not. Let me start with you, Harold, and then go over to Joe. I mean, you had some interesting things to say to our producers today when they were talking before the show about why you think this is taking place and what you think is the underlying root and what to do about it. Give us your thoughts first.
Oh, thank you. It's a convoluted process. I was incarcerated for 20 years in the Maryland prison system, started in the Maryland Penitentiary in 1986 and spent 4 years there. Many of these individuals, and you can't paint them with a broad brush, but many are hopeless. At the time, we no longer have the death penalty in the state now because the governor just signed off on abolishing that. But at the time, when I was in the Maryland Penitentiary, we did have the gas chamber. And there were T-shirts produced with an image of an electric chair. Maryland doesn't have an electric chair, but the caption read, "Why do we kill people who kill people? To show that killing is wrong." So individuals that on the street that would think about committing crimes, they aren't watching the news with the perspective of, you know, I may get that amount of time. So it has not been proven to be a deterrent, the death penalty. And I'm glad to see that it's been abolished in Maryland.
So, but I'm going to come back to more of your specifics about why you think it's been happening in the prisons. But Joe Cassidy, your thoughts. I mean, the question of violence in prisons, I think there's a lot of people would say that. But one of the things I posed to Mark Venarelli, which was from the left as opposed to the conservative side, which was the death penalty as part, like banning that as part of the problem, which we'll get to. But the other issue being that we maybe lock up just too many people. Our prisons are overcrowded. There's no way for the prisons to police themselves given the numbers of people who are incarcerated.
Well, then I guess the question is, so which victims do I go to and say, okay, there are too many people in prison, so the guy that killed your relatives or the person who put a gun in your face and robbed you, we're going to give them a break this week because prisons are too crowded. I mean, I'm not sure how you want me to answer that question other than the fact that people are in prison for a reason. I mean, it's not just a lottery drawing and you lost. If there are too many people, if the prison people are having trouble controlling the violence in the prison because there are not enough of them, then maybe we need to look at staffing levels or something like that. But I'm not sure who I'm supposed to advise that. The people that are victimized them aren't going to prison this week because we just got a notice that we're full and we're, you know, and until further notice, nobody else gets in.
Well, I guess just to push that a little further before the guests jump in, the idea that that a huge number of our prisoners, I'm going to look up the exact number, well over half are there for nonviolent crimes, for people who are drug addicted, that's part of what swells our prison system, not the smaller numbers of people who actually commit serious armed robberies, rape, murder, things that violate other human beings, the reckless drivers that kill people. I mean, people who are not necessarily a danger to society, more of a danger to themselves, even though they commit a crime. That's what people are arguing. Maybe those people, we should find a system different than incarceration that would change the nature of our system.
Well, but again, most of the folks that are in there, when you say they're in there for nonviolent offenses, it's not their generally it's not their first nonviolent offense that ends up putting them in prison. You know, it's the fact that they have been sent to drug treatment and walk off or don't participate or you know, commit other crimes and violate probation. So. I mean, I think if you look at really why people are in there, it's generally when we end up sending people into the Division of Corrections, you know, it's their fourth or fifth or sixth crime before they end up doing real time in the Division of Correction. And yes, it may be nonviolent crimes, but what are you going to do? I mean, you're just going to say, okay, we'll quit enforcing these because, you know, we don't want too many people in prison.
Well, before we go to break, Joaquin, go ahead.
I mean, I just heard a whole lot. First of all, I mean, to say that when people go to prison, usually it's their fourth or fifth, sixth crime, that's a blatant lie. I went to prison, my first adult charge ever. It wasn't like it was, oh, let's see what we can do to help this young man, anything of that nature. No, I went to prison. So
okay, but what was your first adult crime or charge ever?
I mean, I think that's really irrelevant. I mean, I'm just making a statement to what you
I'm
just
sorry,
said.
If your first adult
I mean, excuse
crime
me, I'll let you speak.
Murder,
can you let me cry,
don't you
speak?
Think you should go to prison?
Let's have one at a time. Well, Heath, and then we're going to go to break here in about 30 seconds, but take us there.
Thank you. If somebody is committing crimes, nobody commits crimes just out of thin air, like, oh, let me go rob somebody. People rob people because they broke. Nobody says, oh, I'm just going to jump out of a building today and just, you know, I'm going to go and start shooting people up. That is rare for people to just start killing people for random reasons. People kill because they're trying to protect themselves and because of the environments they live in. If you've never been in that type of environment, then I don't think you're really in a position to even speak on it. If you've never
so
been
you know
in prison,
why the guy
then
in
you
Boston
not then you then you shouldn't be.
And killed other
I don't
people.
Know the man who's from, who was in Boston and killed them people. I ain't got nothing
well,
to do with that.
Well, let me we take a break. We'll come back, and I'm going to kind of probe just what contains violence in prison and why it becomes a very violent place, and what should be our response? 410-319-8888. Keith and Taheem are our first callers up. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We are exploring what's happening in our prison systems. I remind you on the way there, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the University of Maryland Transplant Program. Nearly 2,000 Marylanders are waiting for an organ transplant. The University of Maryland conducts research and performs procedures designed to optimize transplant rates and provide least invasive surgeries for organ donors. More information about the University of Maryland's Transplant Program and becoming an organ donor is available at umm.edu/transplant. We are here talking with Joe Cassidy, Harford County State's Attorney. And Joe, how long have you been State's Attorney? How many years is it now?
Since 83.
83.
Yeah.
So, a long time. Waheed Shakur, incarcerated 15, released to 20, works the American Friends Services Committee, as does Dominique Stevenson, where she's Program Director, and the organization, and also helps run the organization called Friend of a Friend, inside of our prison systems. Harold Bailey, who did 20 years in our state prison system, is now a OSI fellow, partnering with Turk House, a recovery center, working with peer counseling and working to help men coming back from prison transfer from those facilities back to society. Number here is 410-319-8888. Can we go right to the phones and get our listeners in and get their mm-hmm. thoughts? Keith in Nottingham, Maryland, you're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing, Mark?
Very well.
Hey, Mr. Bailey, if this is the same Mr. Bailey that I'm I used to go to Coppin State University with. I don't know if it's the same guy.
That's not, correct.
How you doing, sir? I'm glad that, you know, everything is going fairly well for you. And I just want to know, my question to you is that what is being done at places like Turk House and other places like Turk House to cut down on people going back, men and women, going back to prison, and I'll let you guys answer. And I got to congratulate my man. Good to hear your voice.
Thank you so much, and thank you for the question. What is being done by Turk House is employment readiness trainings provided by me, but also essential life skills. And I do assist men and women that have been formerly incarcerated at four facilities, three in Baltimore City of Turk House and one in Howard County. So what I want to do is to increase confidence of individuals that have been formerly incarcerated. I have, but that's not my only credential. I have a master's degree in education, vocational rehabilitation counseling. So I want to increase academic and employment outcomes citywide for this population and train trainers. Historically, in the United States, substance abuse counselors have been individuals that have X amount of years of sobriety after substance abuse issues, and many of them go on to earn A8 Associate of Arts degrees in substance abuse counseling, so they've lived it, and they're professionally trained to assist the population. So I'm trying to replicate what I've been able to achieve since my transition out of incarceration.
And I'll get back to the heart of what we're talking about here, and on the way there, I'm sorry I have to break in and say this, that it's just been reported from the Chicago Tribune. We have the update on the Boston shootings, the Boston terror incident, that two suspects have been arrested, according to the Chicago Tribune, because they were singled out in surveillance videos of the scene from a department store across the street. And as U.S. counterterrorism and law enforcement officials said, that the suspects in the Boston bombings were seen in the department store video that caught images of a man leaving a backpack near the finish line. And a second federal official said he had been briefed that authorities believe a second video or photo showed two men with two backpacks. And the more we know, we'll tell you during the course of the hour. So that's the latest news from Boston. So let's go to our next caller and then jump back into the heart of what we're talking about. Taheem, you're on the air.
Come in?
Yes, you're on the air, Taheem. Go ahead.
Thank you. I just want to say, because I was listening to the gentleman before the gentleman that just got off the phone, and, you know, I've heard so many people blame their incarceration on environment. You understand? To me, that's a lot of bull. You understand? There are so many people that have grown up in environments and have succeeded beyond. You know what I mean? They separated this. You can separate yourself from the element anytime you want. You know, there's been countless people blaming their incarceration or their other hardships on the environment. And it's just so easy to separate yourself from that type of element. I have been locked up before, you understand? Since I was 16, I started going when I was 16, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. I did three state bids, and I even did federal time. And it's been 13 years since I have been in any type of trouble like that. But I just wanted to put that out there. You know, people can learn how to separate themselves from that element instead of, you know, blaming the environment.
Okay, Taheem, I think we got that. Let me let Waheed responds, and then go back to where we're talking about. Go ahead.
To me, everything the brother just said was a total contradiction. Obviously, if people can separate themselves, how come he didn't? If he said he did three state bids and he did Fed time.
He said he separated himself after he got out.
And I did the same thing. But obviously, he fell into it just like many other people. If you fell into it too, then obviously it's not that easy. If you can't walk out your door and get a job and feed your family, obviously it's not that easy. If you can't walk out your door and don't worry about getting shot or and things of that nature, then obviously it's not that easy. So, I mean, you got to put the root of the problem where the root of the problem is. I'm not saying after you learn your lesson and you know better that you can't, that you're not held accountable. I know better. I'm held accountable. I'm not a child no more. When you are a child in these type of situations, I was 12 years old on my own. If you ain't ever walked in my shoes, you can't tell me nothing about mine. So if I was 12 years old and I had somebody to take care of me and do the things that needed to be done for me, maybe I wouldn't have went out there. But it is what it is.
So I guess that kind of comes back to where we were leaving off. And the question is, but it's a multifold question. And we were talking about whether or not we think our prisons are overcrowded or not. And Joe, let's come back to where we left off with that. I mean, is there a way our prison system is structured is part of the issue. I mean, there are places throughout the Western world that kind of take people who are, whether it's narcotics or the issues that don't hurt or are not kind of are self-inflicting wounds and not inflicting wounds on others, they are not incarcerated. Is that part of – I mean, I'm going to go back to where I was left off with you. If that isn't part of the issue, that just our over-incarceration leads to some of the madness and violence we find ourselves in prisons, especially with nonviolent offenders ended up being with hardened criminals, people who are murderers and rapists and more. And I tell you just very quickly that, you know, in my years of working in the prison, the two things I came out of with was that I felt like most men that I worked with and met in Hagerstown shouldn't be in prison, could be kind of dealt with in other ways. But there were a body of men who I wish would never see the light of day as well. So, I mean, so I wonder your thoughts. And then we'll go back to our guest in the studio. Joe?
Yeah, Mark. It's one of those things that, as when I understand what you're saying, I look around the world, and in some places, they don't put people in jail as long. I mean, and part of the question is, do we think that that is just? I mean, you know, part of the reason that we put people in prison is not just rehabilitation; it's punishment. It's a sense of what is a fair punishment. And you can point to some place like Spain, where they, you know, the guy that bombed the train and killed 200 people in Spain, and he received, 20-year sentence in prison. You know, in the United States, depending on what jurisdiction, he may have ended up in the, you know, in prison for life or the death penalty or something like that. You look at, I believe it was Sweden, where the gunman came in and shot up the parliament and attacked a bunch of people, and he got 13 years in jail. You know, how do you feel about it? Do you feel that that's justice? You know, we would probably put somebody like that in jail for life. I mean, I don't think that those sentences in those countries, I don't believe that that's fair. I don't think you should, you know, be able to cause that kind of damage and prove yourself to be a danger to society like that and simply, you know, be able to get out of prison ever and walk around. So it's an issue where you can point to other countries and say, well, they don't put people in jail as often as we do. I don't know. My personal opinion is, that's not justice. That's not, you know, respecting, you know, the damage that they've caused and the harm to the victims that they've caused. But,
well, regarding the American penal system, it's an outbranching of the American judicial system, and individuals are sentenced to prison as punishment, not for punishment. So when individuals go into prison and unfortunately lose their lives, or, you know, we're talking about deaths, some deaths are not physical deaths. Some individuals come out after being institutionalized, have not been habilitated, not even to talk about rehabilitated, and they are very upset and act out negatively. I mean, if you incarcerate somebody and treat them like an animal and feed them like an animal, what is your expectation of them when they come out? They're going to act just in line with that. But I'd like to take issue with this lottery system that the state's attorney from Harford County, Mr. Casey, I believe, referenced, that we don't have a lottery system. Well, the American judicial system is not about justice and fairness, in my humble opinion, from my experience and observation. It's about how much justice can you afford. So it's not about fairness, in my estimation, if you can't afford a competent lawyer. And in the Maryland penal system, 73.8% of the males that are incarcerated are African-American males. So something is askew there.
Yeah. What is justice? Okay, I mean, really, honestly, in this country, what is justice? Is justice sending a 15-year-old or 14-year-old into an adult prison? Is that justice? Is that going to somehow shift what has occurred on the street? Is that going to make up for the supposed crime that has occurred? You know, there really is not much justice for people of African descent. If we really want to get down to it, we can attempt to sit here and act like race is not a critical part, you know, in this whole issue of mass incarceration. But to me, it is the core component when you look at mass incarceration. People of African descent or black folks commit crime in proportion to our numbers in the population, which is about 13% and 15%. Okay,
but yet we make up a disproportionate amount of the prison system.
I don't expect someone who sends people to prison for life to see eye to eye with me. Okay, so I'm not on here to really debate the state's attorney. But the reality is I've seen 14-year-old children in these prisons in Maryland. You're giving children sentences of 50 years, life sentences. Okay, so you are actually instilling in them no hope. So what you get in that system is what you get. You get you're going to get violence. People are going to get frustrated. But the other part of it that I think is being ignored is that what I heard Mark Vernarelli say is that in four of these killings, the cellmate is the suspect. Suspect does not mean conviction. It doesn't mean that that cellmate did it. There are some things that are very questionable. There have been indictments out in Hagerstown of correctional officers in beatings. Okay, we can act like these things don't take place in Maryland prisons, but they do. Public safety does a very good job of keeping those things quiet and keeping those things from the public.
Before we go to the phone, Joe, you were trying to say something. And we'll go back to the phones.
I'm sorry, but what she just said about, I mean, that race, that the commission of crimes is in proportion to the race in society is absolutely not correct. I mean, look,
it is true if you look at the entire country and don't look at an urban area that has a majority black population.
Maryland penal system. Look at Maryland. That the two jurisdictions with the highest murder rates are Baltimore City and Prince George's County, and the majority of the people who live there are African American. All right,
I think you made my point.
What do you mean?
I'm saying those are majority areas. If you only look at it that way, of course you're going to see a majority of blacks committing crimes.
I'm looking at those areas as committing more crimes in those two areas than the rest of the state combined.
Except
look at it nationally.
88% of all homicides in Maryland are committed by African Americans. That is not just this year. That is a statistic that has existed in Maryland for the last 20 years, somewhere in the low or high 70s to mid 80 range of all.
You're speaking convictions?
Murder victims are African Americans, and of all murder suspects are African Americans.
Well, so let me just jump in for a minute. Another caller I want to bring in who's just called in, who I know is Greg Carpenter from the Jericho Project, so you can bring him into the conversation. But I think that the problem of the discussion that we're having right now, at least from my perspective, is while it might be true that in Maryland that most murders are committed within the African American community, I think there's no question about that.
No.
And that, just like 100 years ago, 50 years ago, when my father was a kid, the murder rates were high in Irish-American communities that were living in poverty and high in a lot of communities that lived in poverty. And that there's no mistaking that poverty breeds violence that breeds these kind of killings that take place. But the issue of people getting convicted is that every study has shown that the majority of people in America, the more people in America who buy drugs, use drugs, and sell drugs are white.
Absolutely.
They are not in jail. They don't get arrested. They don't get charged for numerous reasons.
Not
because police don't arrest them, because people do it because it's not in the street. So, I mean, people don't get busted. And so that's part of the problem, is that the over-incarceration mm-hmm. of people for nonviolent crimes who are communities of color in this country, and white people who do the exact same things every day do not get arrested and do not go to jail.
And then I'm not convinced that, and I'd have to see the statistics for the Division of Correction, which is where the violence is that you're talking about is occurring. Okay, I can admit that our local county jails and stuff are often used for people for incarcerating nonviolent offenders, but in the Division of Correction, I need statistics or I need something else to show me that in fact that's the case.
Well, let me. We can have that debate another day, because I think we need to have that debate, and that's important. But I may just also bring in, before you come back, let me bring in Greg Carpenter, who just called in. I know he's with the Jericho Project. Greg, welcome. Good to have you with us for a minute.
I'm on.
Greg, is that Greg?
Yeah. How you doing, Mark? And how you doing to the panel? I think I know most of the people that.
Hey, what's up, big bro?
How you doing, Greg?
So, Good. We do work together and so forth and so on. But just a little bit, Jericho Reentry is a program that provides reentry and job readiness services to individuals coming back to the community after spending, you know, periods of incarceration. But I think, you know, from the observation, just, you know, about what prisons would look like, are they overcrowded, and, you know, what could be different, and how can attest to this, because he spoke about a period of time when the pendulum was swinging along rehabilitation, and there were more programs that were education. Individuals had the opportunity to actually get four-year college degrees and some instances, master's degrees while they were in prison. And so if individuals are given an opportunity to continue to work on themselves and become better people inside, then I think that would have a different look. And at the same time, crimes that people are being incarcerated for, it may be some alternatives, because when we think about the justice reinvestment model, and we look at programs like Jericho are able to provide services for a year or so for approximately $4,000 to $5,000, when it takes, you know, 30,000+ or whatever that number may be at this point to house an individual, you know, for a crime that they probably should not even been incarcerated for. So, yes, the penal system is probably well overcrowded. And so I think that when we talk about it, what does it look like and how can it change, I think that the department and the community as well can do more, you know, to look at rehabilitative measures and look at more programs that could produce better citizens.
Okay.
In inside and outside.
Good.
So, thank you for those comments, Greg. It's heartfelt what you were saying, because I have, been incarcerated for a couple of decades. And the biggest problem that I have run into out here in the work that I'm doing with all the accomplishments is with the Division of Corrections. And I've come to the conclusion that it is not best practice for some people in penology to not have people come back to prison. It would put them out of employment, those correctional officers. So it is a stumbling block, and if I'm treated like this, with the degrees that I hold, with the fellowship that I've achieved, I'm just feel really bad for the population that we are all trying to effectively service.
Can I ask, do we know who the people are that are committing the murders? I mean, you're talking about providing programs and providing opportunities, and that somehow will impact the violence. And the question is, I recently spoke to a prosecutor from Washington County, where a lot of the state institutions are located, and he's prosecuting murderers who are there doing life sentences. I mean, these aren't people that are looking to come out of the institution. These are people that are going to be there because of they're already serving sentences for murders. So the question is, if there's no punishment, which they realize there's no punishment, what's the purpose of prosecuting them?
Well, there's a flip side.
Let me get Waheed's been trying to jump in here.
I mean, I feel like we basically like running in a circle. If been clearly stated earlier that the statistics state that the majority of the people who are incarcerated for nonviolent crimes. Okay, that's established. So why
no,
do you keep bringing?
Not to my
listen,
note. Not,
when
no,
you talk,
I don't
speak. When you talk, I don't speak. When I talk, please don't speak. That's all I'm asking you. If the majority of the people who are locked up is not locked up for violent crimes, why do we keep going back to murders and things of that nature? That is irrelevant. You're talking about a small number of people who are incarcerated for murder. If you got people sitting on a tier all day doing nothing, looking at another man, getting sick of you looking in my face, I don't have anything to do. What do you expect to happen? Tensions run high when people have absolutely nothing to do. I started going to jail when I was 12 years old, and from when I was 12 years old to I was 20 years old and I was released, I've seen prison and jail, all of the programming is being pushed out. There's nothing more coming in. You got phony, rinky-dink programs, I'm just being honest, coming in there, like AVP and things of that nature, that's doing absolutely nothing for you, but you don't have anything that's sitting there that's really trying to help a brother or a sister, for the sisters that's locked up, to really move themselves along during their incarceration, so when they get back on the streets, they don't have to face the same problems. I don't see that.
It seems to me that the question, though, is what is leading to homicides inside of the institution?
I just answered your question.
And, no, you didn't, because the question is, who are the people that are committing the homicides? Are they people that are in there for, quote, nonviolent offenses?
Some staff members. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. For the
murder?
Western District is currently under investigation, is it not? You know, in beatings of prisoners. So, yeah, we want to know who the people are, too, because we're not quite certain that it's the cell buddy. We're not quite certain that it's another prisoner. We're not going to deny that that happens. But the reality is they're not the only people inside who are setting the tone for the acceptability of that violence.
And if you look at the murder that happened up in Cumberland with the young brother who only had 18 months, Cumberland is a maximum security prison. Why is somebody with 18 months sitting inside of a cell in a maximum security prison? That's first of all, that's out of line number one. Then a brother get killed, they blame it on the cell buddy, but when they look at the boot prints that was sitting all on a brother's face, you got different type of boot prints on his face. Now you think a cell buddy is gonna stomp your face in, change your shoes, stomp your face in, change your shoes, and then stomp your face in again? Is that even realistic? No, so, that means more than one person was in there, and they was police boot prints.
So, I think a lot of the murders that happened in our prisons have not been solved. People don't, inside the joint, do not talk about who does what. So the people don't know who committed a lot of prisons. We do know that a lot of prisoners who have been murdered were there for nonviolent crimes or who were almost on their way out. So there's a lot of complexity to this. I wish we had more time, but we have to take a break here. And first of all, Joe Cassidy, I appreciate you always being willing to come on this program.
Thanks, Mark.
Harford County State's Attorney. Waheed Shakur, good to see you again.
Thank
you. Good to have you. Dominique Stevenson, always
thank
pleasure
you.
To see you. And we'll be talking again next week with the Eddie Conway story. And Harold Bailey,
thank you very much,
again.
Mark.
We're going to take a very brief break, and when we come back, we're going to do another one of our stories from the press. We have a conversation with Jal Mehta, who wrote a really important piece in the New York Times over the weekend. About teaching education. It was entitled, Teachers, Will We Ever Learn? Fascinating take on testing and more. Stay with us.